The Marquis de Sade's notorious masterpiece stands as perhaps the most controversial work in literary history. Written in 1785 while imprisoned in the Bastille, this manuscript wasn't published until 1904, over a century after the author's death. Despite its infamy, the book has influenced countless artists and philosophers, from Simone de Beauvoir to Michel Foucault, who saw in its extreme content a radical critique of social power. Susan Sontag called it the most pornographic work ever written, while Albert Camus considered it essential reading for understanding the dark potential of human nature. Even today, celebrities like Nick Cave and Bjork cite Sade's unflinching exploration of taboo as influential to their artistic vision. The book's cultural impact is so profound that the term sadism entered our vocabulary directly from the author's name, a testament to how thoroughly this work has permeated our understanding of human sexuality and cruelty. Deep in a remote forest, beyond France's borders, stands the Château de Sillings, an isolated fortress that becomes the setting for an exploration of human nature's darker aspects. Four influential members of French society, representing aristocracy, clergy, law, and finance, orchestrate an extended retreat designed to test the boundaries of moral philosophy. After extensive planning and selection processes, they arrive with a carefully chosen group of participants, their spouses, arranged in calculated marriages, young wards, selected for their perceived purity, experienced storytellers, chosen for their extensive life knowledge, attendants, and support staff. Upon arrival, they deliberately seal off all access to the outside world, creating an isolated domain where their authority remains absolute for the duration of their 4-month stay. The architectural design of the chateau serves as a powerful metaphor for psychological descent. The structure occupies a precarious position atop a mountain peak, surrounded by deep valleys and previously accessible only by a single bridge. Its Gothic features include towering spires, winding passages, and observation points designed for surveillance and control. A concealed stairway beneath the chapel leads to multiple subterranean levels, each representing deeper stages of psychological exploration. This downward journey symbolizes the participants' calculated rejection of societal norms and traditional values, transforming sacred spaces into theaters for challenging conventional morality. The chateau functions as a carefully constructed microcosm where traditional values are systematically questioned and inverted. Conventional virtue faces consequences, while transgression receives reward. Every aspect of daily life within its walls follows strict protocols designed to test philosophical boundaries. The architecture enables constant observation, with strategic vantage points allowing the organizers to monitor all activities. This architectural symbolism reinforces the philosophical experiment, creating a controlled environment where human nature, removed from societal constraints and conventional morality, reveals what the orchestrators believe to be its fundamental essence, the complex relationship between power, pleasure, and suffering. The Libertines establish an intricate and rigid system of rules governing every minute aspect of life at the chateau, creating a micromanaged dystopia of absolute control. Rising precisely at 10 each morning, the inhabitants must follow elaborate meal rituals, participate in scheduled storytelling sessions, and engage in carefully orchestrated orgies, all conducted with military precision. This constitution of libertinage serves as a dark mirror to conventional social order, complete with its own perverted ceremonies and protocols. The daily routine begins with morning inspections, conducted by a rotating steward position that starts with Dorset. These inspections are performed with bureaucratic thoroughness, checking clothing, cleanliness, and compliance with the previous day's orders. Subjects must maintain specific postures, kneel before the libertines, and address them as "my lord," reinforcing a power dynamic that goes beyond mere authority to complete psychological domination. Any infraction, no matter how minor, is meticulously recorded in a register for later punishment. This meticulously organized system reveals Saad's sophisticated critique of social institutions and power structures. The chateau's regulations deliberately mirror society's laws while inverting their stated moral purpose, creating order not to protect the vulnerable, but to systematize their exploitation. The libertine's obsession with rules and procedures demonstrates how tyranny often operates through bureaucratic systems rather than random violence. By establishing their own parallel legal code, complete with inspections, trials, and punishments, they create a miniature society where power is exercised with methodical precision and pseudo-legal authority. The system's most disturbing aspect lies in its transformation of natural functions into opportunities for control and degradation. Basic bodily needs become weapons of domination. Subjects can only relieve themselves at specified times with explicit permission, and only in the chapel, which has been deliberately desecrated and converted into a privy where the libertines can observe them. This control over fundamental bodily functions represents the ultimate form of domination, reducing victims to purely physical beings whose every natural impulse becomes an occasion for humiliation and subjugation. The chapel's conversion specifically serves to destroy any possibility of spiritual comfort or moral refuge, completing the system's totalitarian grip on both body and soul. Through this elaborate system, Saad illustrates how institutional power operates not through chaos, but through careful organization, showing how the tools of civilization can be turned to serve the most uncivilized ends. The libertine's regime demonstrates how systematic oppression can be more effective than arbitrary violence, and how bureaucracy can serve as a mask for brutality. The four libertine protagonists embody different aspects of corrupt power. The Duc de Blangy, described as a monstrous satyr-like figure, represents brute physical force. His brother, the bishop, combines religious authority with refined depravity. President de Kerval, an emaciated embodiment of libertinage, represents corrupted judicial power. Dursat, the feminine banker, symbolizes the perversion of financial power. Together, they form a comprehensive critique of institutional authority. Their wives stand in stark contrast, each representing a different form of virtue under assault. Constance possesses Roman beauty and innate virtue. Adelaide maintains romantic sensibilities despite her circumstances. Julie displays a complex mixture of corruption and remaining humanity, while young Aline maintains a mischievous innocence, detesting the infamies she endures. These women represent the spectrum of possible responses to systematic oppression, from noble resistance to reluctant accommodation. The storytellers, Duclos, Champville, Martain, and Desgranges, function as historians of depravity, each specializing in increasingly severe categories of perversion. Their narratives form the backbone of the libertine's education in vice, providing both inspiration and instruction. By structuring the novel around these tales, Saad creates a taxonomy of human perversion that progresses from simple sexual peculiarities to elaborate tortures and murder. This careful social organization creates a microcosm of society where power relationships are stripped of their conventional justifications. The chateau becomes a laboratory where human nature, freed from moral constraints, reveals its fundamental drives. Saad's vision suggests that when absolute power meets absolute freedom, the result is not liberation, but new forms of tyranny, a disturbing insight that continues to resonate in our understanding of political systems and human psychology. The narrative centers on 16 adolescents from privileged backgrounds, evenly divided between males and females, aged 12 to 15, who become subjects of systematic manipulation. Carefully chosen for their refined qualities, these young nobles experience a calculated process of psychological conditioning that forms the emotional foundation of the account. The text examines the varied psychological responses to sustained trauma. Some subjects, like Augustine, develop adaptive behaviors that paradoxically reinforce their exploitation. Others, such as Zellmeyer, seek refuge in spiritual practices, which leads to increased negative attention. Sophie's emotional attachment to her deceased mother's memory becomes weaponized against her, demonstrating how natural familial bonds are deliberately misused. The perpetrators orchestrate artificial social connections between the subjects, creating superficial relationships only to deliberately disrupt them. These manufactured scenarios serve as mockeries of societal institutions. When authentic emotional bonds develop naturally, as in the case of Adelaide and Sophie seeking mutual support, these connections are severely discouraged, revealing the orchestrator's systematic opposition to genuine human relationships. The most significant psychological insight concerns the gradual transformation of some subjects into active participants. Julie, whose father holds authority, begins displaying behavioral changes that align her with the established power structure. This progression illustrates a profound observation about institutional abuse: its capacity to transform some subjects into facilitators through psychological conditioning rather than physical coercion, thereby perpetuating cycles of systematic manipulation. Beyond its shocking content, the work presents a coherent philosophical system articulated through the libertines' discussions. When the Duke justifies matricide, declaring that nature often inspires what mortals call criminal impulses, he articulates a fundamental principle of Sadean philosophy, that conventional morality contradicts natural drives. Kerville expands this thinking, asserting that nothing's villainous if it causes an erection, and the single crime that exists in this world is to refuse oneself anything that might produce a discharge. These philosophical dialogues reveal Sade's radical materialism, a worldview that reduces all human experience to physical sensation and rejects transcendent moral principles. When Dursett argues against charity, claiming that inequality is natural and aiding the poor disrupts nature's intentions, he articulates a dark parody of Enlightenment rationalism that uses reason to justify cruelty rather than compassion. The libertines' discussions about sensibility, whether emotional sensitivity contributes to human happiness, reveal Sade's critique of Enlightenment sentimentalism. Kerville argues that sensibility should be extirpated from children through exposure to ferocious spectacles, directly challenging Rousseau's educational philosophy that emphasized natural emotional development. This systematic assault on Enlightenment values reveals Sade not merely as a pornographer, but as a philosophical radical challenging the foundations of modern thought. Most provocatively, the libertines find their greatest pleasure in blasphemy and religious desecration. When they consecrate hosts for the purpose of defilement or force victims to renounce their faith before murder, they enact a theatrical rejection of transcendent morality. Adelaide's persistent religious devotion, described as a true disease of the soul, becomes her most punishable offense precisely because it represents resistance to the libertine's materialist worldview. The work's structure follows a deliberate progression through increasingly extreme forms of perversion, demonstrating Sade's methodical approach to exploring human depravity. Divided into four parts corresponding to the storyteller's narratives, it moves from Duclos's simple passions, involving relatively mild forms of sexual deviation and voyeurism, through Champville's complex passions, featuring elaborate scenarios of domination and humiliation. This continues through Martin's criminal passions, involving permanent bodily harm, before culminating in Desgrange's murderous passions, where sexuality and death become inextricably linked. This taxonomic approach creates a narrative of escalation that mirrors the libertine's own journey into extremity, while simultaneously serving as a dark reflection of Enlightenment-era classification systems. This structure reflects Sade's understanding of transgression as inherently progressive. Conventional pleasures inevitably lead to satiety, driving the libertine toward increasingly extreme acts. As Kerville explains, satiety of common pleasures leads to abominations. The libertines begin with relatively straightforward acts of sexual dominance, but find themselves requiring ever more elaborate scenarios to achieve satisfaction. This psychological insight, that transgression creates its own momentum, remains one of Sade's most disturbing contributions to our understanding of human sexuality and violence. Each new transgression normalizes previous ones, creating an endless cycle of escalation that Sade suggests is inherent to human desire itself. The progression culminates in elaborate torture scenarios combining sexual gratification with methodical cruelty. In the final sections, libertines devise increasingly complex methods of suffering, from machines that slowly dismember victims to elaborate psychological tortures that force family members to participate in each other's destruction. These scenarios become increasingly theatrical, with precise staging and timing requirements, suggesting that the imagination's capacity for cruelty far exceeds physical limitations. Sade describes these tortures with architectural precision, including detailed specifications for machines and devices, demonstrating how rational planning can be put to irrational ends. This systematic exploration of cruelty suggests that human imagination, freed from moral constraints, finds its ultimate expression not in pleasure, but in the infliction of pain. Throughout this progression, Sade maintains a clinical detachment, cataloging perversions with scientific precision and taxonomic rigor. Each passion is numbered, classified, and analyzed according to its components and effects. This combination of extreme content with rational organization creates the work's distinctive tone, a cold-blooded intellectualization of atrocity that implicates the reader in its analytical approach to suffering. By forcing us to engage with depravity through reason rather than emotion, Sade challenges our assumption that rationality naturally leads to moral behavior. The work's meticulous organization suggests that reason itself can become an instrument of cruelty when divorced from moral considerations, presenting a fundamental challenge to Enlightenment assumptions about the relationship between rationality and virtue. The chateau serves as a ceremonial venue where social dynamics manifest through formal rituals. The daily gatherings occur in a custom-designed circular hall where the speaker occupies an elevated position, with 16 young participants arranged in geometric patterns before designated alcoves connected by decorative garlands. This careful arrangement emphasizes how authority requires witnesses and unfolds through orchestrated ceremonies. The residents' preoccupation with surveillance shapes the narrative. They create observation points, use reflecting surfaces to enhance their supervision, and organize formal presentations for maximum impact. This emphasis on observation demonstrates how visual control reinforces social authority. By reducing individuals to subjects of observation, the powerful figures establish dominance through calculated distance and scrutiny. Even routine activities become ceremonial displays. When young attendants are instructed to serve beverages through unconventional methods, natural behaviors are transformed into displays of status hierarchy. The requirement that participants use only specific language further shows how speech becomes another venue for control, with regulated communication serving as another form of influence. Most notably, the mock ceremonies create elaborate parodies of social conventions. When two young participants engage in a staged ritual with authority figures playing reversed parental roles, complete with non-traditional attire, social institutions face theatrical critique. These performances reveal how power operates not just through direct authority, but through the manipulation of cultural symbols and ceremonies. A complex economic system underlies the libertines' pursuit of pleasure. The initial procurement of victims involves substantial financial transactions, selecting from hundreds of candidates, paying families, and establishing elaborate contracts. This commodification of human beings reveals the economic foundations of exploitation, with wealth enabling the purchase of absolute power over others. The chateau operates on a strict economy of bodily fluids and sensations. The libertines become increasingly frugal with their seed as they realize they'll need to ration their sexual energy. They carefully manage their diet to produce specific effects on their excrement, eliminating bread to create more mellow, softer waste with an infinitely more subtle flavor. This meticulous management of bodily economy reveals how even apparently natural functions become subject to calculation and control. Most disturbing is the economy of suffering, where pain becomes a currency exchanged for pleasure. When Duclos describes a client who pays according to how many enemas a prostitute will accept, physical discomfort is directly monetized. The libertines themselves establish an elaborate accounting system of punishments, keeping a fatal book of infractions that will be settled on designated days of retribution. This bureaucratization of cruelty reveals how systems of accounting can facilitate rather than constrain atrocity. Even language participates in this economy. The storytellers are rewarded based on the quality of their narratives and their ability to excite their audience. When Duclos and Champfil receive applause equal to each other, they are compensated with the privilege of dining with the libertines. This commodification of narrative reveals how stories themselves become products within systems of exploitation, a disturbing reflection on the status of literature itself. As the narrative progresses, the libertines repeatedly confront the limitations of their own depravity. The bishop laments that his imagination exceeded what he could actually accomplish, revealing a fundamental gap between fantasy and reality that drives the libertines toward increasingly elaborate scenarios. This insatiability suggests that transgression creates its own momentum, with each boundary crossed merely revealing new horizons of possibility. The manuscript's unfinished nature, ending with the author's notes for revision, reinforces this sense of perpetual incompletion. Sade's meticulous instructions to himself, keep a notebook with character names, the first part should be softened, reveal the work as an ongoing project of imagination rather than a completed artifact. This structural openness mirrors the libertine's own endless pursuit of new extremes. Most significantly, the work concludes with a vision of ultimate depravity that exists only in imagination. A nobleman who subjects 15 beautiful girls to 15 different torture machines simultaneously, observing their suffering while demons display their asses to him. This fantastical scenario, impossible to realize physically, suggests that the ultimate expression of libertinage transcends material reality into pure conceptual perversion, a mathematical perfection of cruelty that exists only in the mind. This confrontation with imaginative limits reveals Sade's most profound insight, that human desire, particularly when divorced from moral constraints, creates an infinite regress of transgression that can never reach satisfaction. The libertine's pursuit becomes not pleasure itself, but the perpetual overcoming of boundaries, an endless negation that ultimately consumes itself. In this recognition of desire's inherent insatiability, Sade anticipates modern psychoanalytic understandings of human sexuality as fundamentally driven by lack rather than fulfillment. Despite its 18th-century origins, the work presents disturbing parallels to modern systems of oppression. The libertines' meticulous record-keeping, their obsession with schedules and regulations, and their systematic categorization of perversions anticipate the bureaucratization of atrocity in totalitarian regimes. When the Duke explains his system of colored ribbons to identify which child belongs to whom for deflowering rites, we see the administrative logic that would later enable mass atrocities. The chateau's isolation, achieved through destroying bridges and walling up entrances, creates a closed system where conventional morality ceases to apply. This state of exception parallels modern concentration camps and black sites where normal legal protections are suspended. The libertines' insistence that their victims use only the most lascivious and blasphemous language similarly reflects how totalitarian systems control not just actions, but speech itself. Most disturbingly, the work reveals how systems of oppression create their own internal logic that normalizes atrocity. When Kerval philosophizes that nature often inspires what mortals call criminal impulses, he articulates a rationalization for cruelty that echoes modern ideological justifications for violence. The libertine's elaborate philosophical discussions reveal how reason itself can become complicit in atrocity when divorced from moral principles. In this systematic exploration of power's corruption, Saad created not merely a catalog of perversions, but a prophetic vision of modernity's darkest potential. The Chateau's combination of meticulous organization with extreme cruelty anticipates the paradoxical nature of modern atrocities. Not chaotic outbursts of primitive violence, but systematically organized applications of rational principles to irrational ends. This insight makes the work not merely shocking, but genuinely terrifying in its continued relevance to our understanding of human nature and social organization. Beyond its philosophical and political dimensions, the work ultimately confronts us with fundamental questions about human nature itself. The libertine's journey from conventional sexuality to elaborate torture suggests that cruelty may not be an aberration, but a potential inherent in desire itself. When Kerval declares that the more atrocious the crime, the greater the pleasure, he articulates a disturbing connection between transgression and gratification that challenges optimistic views of human psychology. The victim's varied responses, from Adelaide's persistent religious devotion to Julie's gradual corruption, reveal the complex spectrum of human adaptation to systematic abuse. Some maintain their moral integrity despite torture, while others become accomplices in their own degradation. This psychological realism complicates simple narratives of victimhood and resistance, suggesting that human response to oppression exists on a continuum rather than in absolute categories. Most profoundly, the work challenges the Enlightenment belief in natural human goodness. When Durset argues that he derives pleasure from witnessing and causing other suffering, he articulates a vision of humanity where compassion is not innate but constructed, and therefore easily dismantled. The libertine's philosophical discussions repeatedly return to this theme, suggesting that conventional morality represents not human nature's fulfillment, but its repression. In this unflinching exploration of humanity's capacity for cruelty, Sade created a work that continues to disturb, not merely for its explicit content, but for its challenge to our fundamental self-conception. By forcing us to confront the potential for systematic cruelty that exists within human desire and reason themselves, he created a mirror in which we glimpse not merely individual perversion, but collective potential, an abyss of possibility that continues to haunt our understanding of ourselves and our social institutions.